Hello, I'm Stephen Goodwin. It's Tuesday, March the 25th, 2008, and welcome to episode number 19 of The Beer Crate, the podcast for our lovers the world over. Each week, we'll be looking at the world of beer and brewing, investigating local, national, and international breweries, and of course, testing a wide selection of beers, ales, and ciders. Lager boys need not apply. Coming up on today's show, we have news, the drinker's diary, how to pour a perfect beer, the second part of our exclusive interview with John Brown, quick tastings, and our world-famous Try Before You Die. So, let's get cracking. News. And the UK budget has been foremost on our minds this week, as Chancellor Alistair Darling demonstrates how best to lose an election by adding 4p to your standard pint, along with 14p to wine and 55p to spirits. Again, despite recommendations from many bodies, beer is still considered as a single taxable entity, so the idea of taxing alcopops differently have been ignored again. Adding 4p to the price of real ales is certainly not going to stop binge drinking, because ale drinkers were never the problem anyway, and it isn't enough to stop the young drinkers from abusing it, so the problem isn't solved, or averted, and it's merely been used as a means of adding money to the government's coffers. And of course, increasing the trade of supermarket-bought alcohol, and increasing the number of people taking their trade to the continent. More positively, Shepherd Neame have come up with a novel ingredient for its new beer, Scallop Stout. The beer, which has a reported taste of the sea and a hint of smokiness, is made by throwing a handful of scallops into the brew for about an hour. They're also considering a crab-based beer and a Winkle Ale. It'll be interesting to see which, if any, of these flavours take off. Drinker's Diary, and there are five festivals for you this time. The first is at Sidcup for the third Bexley Beer Festival, running from the 27th of March to the 29th. This takes place at Sidcup Sports Club, Crescent Farm. Also from the 27th to the 29th is Doncaster's 18th Beer Festival at The Hub, Chapel Drive, Doncaster, and the Hull Real Ale and Cider Festival at Horncastle Building, Hull College. This one boasts 74 real ales, 25 ciders and perries, Belgium and German beers. The 32nd Newcastle Beer Festival is being held at Newcastle University Student Union from the 2nd of April to the 5th of April. And finally, the 22nd Oldham Beer Festival takes place at the Queen Elizabeth Hall Civic Centre, West Street, Oldham. This runs from the 4th of April to the 5th of April, with live entertainment on both evenings and monies being donated to charity. How to pour beer. This week's first article is in the form of a video, showing us how to pour the perfect beer. It can be found on our own YouTube channel, with the link in the show notes. The first step is to ensure your glass is clean and slightly wet. Then open the beer tap and let the first little bit out from the pipes. Add your glass at a 45 degree angle until the glass is about 3/4 full. Then turn off the tap and wipe the glass. Once the head has finished growing, you can top it up as appropriate. Of course, if you don't get it right the first time, it gives you a good excuse for trying again. And again. And again. We left the interview last time where we were talking about the aging of beer and the fermentation process. But there are many beers which are intended to age further and are classed as bottle fermented.
Bottle fermented actually... Yeah, let's be technical here. It has nothing to do with bacteria. It means having an added residual level of yeast cells in the bottle. And these yeast cells will slowly mop up any extract which is still there and is left either left over from the original fermentation or has been back added with... adding extra sugar or perhaps extract meaning wort sugars, malt sugars, back into the bottle. Now, there's two things that happen, that the yeast cells will then multiply again to a certain degree. This is why you have to keep the dose at modest levels. And also, you have the evolution of CO2, so you don't want these bottles actually exploding in your face. But we do get a very similar effect to champagne. So it is a secondary fermentation in bottle. These beers are very Moorish. They have a very rounded but very complex flavor profile. and they tend to have a very fine petulance, which is a very fine bubble, very fine carbonation. Those are great beers. One just needs to watch that when you pour them, that you leave the sediment behind. And in fact, we now know that until about 200 years ago, champagnes in France were actually dispensed that way as well. It was a secondary bottle fermentation, and people, when they were drinking these champagnes, made sure that the bottom residue, the dead yeast cells, were being left behind. But this has sort of been superseded by other technology these days.
There are also beers which are triple fermented, but are there any which are four times fermented, or is that not possible?
It is technically only possible when you have an addition of other fermentables. As in secondary or tertiary fermentation, you have to always add something back. But you can only do that because yeast, to a certain degree, is quite tolerant of alcohol levels. But the higher the alcohol level is, the more intolerant the yeast becomes. In other words, the weaker it becomes. And we in the brewing industry have this very easy rule of thumb. It sounds glib, it sounds simplistic, but it's so true. Keep the yeast happy and you'll get a good beer. Which means basically that the flavor profiles of beers where the yeast has been compromised in terms of its vitality, in terms of its health, in terms of numbers, is never as good as a beer where the yeast has been kept happy. Bringing ourselves back to the topic that you were saying in terms of secondary and tertiary fermentation, here we have a factor that, or the fact that every time you have another fermentation, you have more alcohol, and the yeast becomes successively unhappy. It leads to a very complex process, and it leads to a very complex flavor profile in that beer. But one needs to know where to draw the line between interesting and flavorsome. So, but that is obviously a thing which is very individualistic.
So with that in mind, is there anything further to add on the drinkability front?
That is a good point, because you know, if you look into the history of the last 20, 30 years in terms of brewing science, it's really been largely characterized by a desire to make, first of all, good beers, and to make then these good beers even better in terms of their flavors. Then the next advance and the next sort of milestone was really to make good beers not only better, but also enable the consumer to buy them longer on the shelf. In other words, to extend their shelf life. And that gets me back to what I was saying in terms of the antioxidants, in terms of aseptic filling practices or anoxic filling practices. So there's a whole realm of stuff there. And with the last 5 to 6 years, we've seen a proliferation of people in the brewing industry really getting down to the nitty-gritty in terms of this, what we call the drinkability. And drinkability is defined as, quite simply, here is a beer, would I actually have another one of this beer, or would I change? And think about it, this has enormous commercial implications to the brewer. If most people would say, hey, this is not only a great beer, but I would have a second one, then, you know, it's all systems go and you're halfway there with your profit forecasts and whatever. But however, if you make a beer which is really great tasting, a wonderfully flavorsome beer, but people would say, you know, this is so good, but I think I'll only have one, thanks very much, I now need something to slake my thirst, then we're onto a completely different ticket, and this is where this aspect of drinkability comes in. And there's a lot of work that's going on in terms of how can we optimize the different harmonies in terms of sweet bitter balance in a beer to try and give people enough flavor for them to like it, but not enough to be, as we call it, satiated by excessive flavor. And in a way, at the moment, this is the talk of the town. This is where the holy grail resides of brewing science at the moment. I personally feel that I mean, talking about drinkability and looking at drinkability in a scientific sense is all fair and well, but you probably would agree with me, Steve, that a lot of the scenarios where we go drinking are very situational. In a way, if you don't like the decor of a pub, you could have the best beer in front of you, but you'd probably make a beeline for the door fairly soon. And all these aspects of the sort of personal environment, the personal feeling, the ambiance, really play in so much with this drinkability aspect. So one needs to, on the one hand, look at all these scientific and technological factors in a beer that enhance drinkability. No problem with that. But at the other, on the other hand, one needs to have the common sense to say, look, hey, this is the best beer in the world, but, you know, these chairs are so uncomfortable, so I'm making a beeline for the door. So here we are.
So much information in your head. There must be a book in there, right?
I've teamed up with a guy that I've actually done projects for in the past, Dr. Bill Simpson. He's a very well-known technical consultant to the brewing industry. Has great knowledge in terms of really the technical aspects of the industry. And he and I have brought out a book together with a third co-author, really looking at problem solving in the industry. My beer has, I'm just giving you an example, my beer is foaming excessively. What is this due to? Could it be this and this? And then there will be a small chapter saying, basically, have you looked at this? And if it's not that, it could be that. And if it's not that, have you considered doing this sort of test? Now, it all sounds very technical, but in fact, the book's been designed in such a way that very technical people, as well as the very interested laity type of person, would be very keen on reading this book. It's very readable because it's got about 250 mini chapters on all aspects of production, in all aspects of serving beer, dispensing beer, beer hygiene, and all the quality aspects that we were talking about, alcohol, head retention value, foam, and so on and so forth. So this is something that I think could be an interesting book. See if you like it is basically the watchword here.
Does it include any end consumer topics, such as when to spot when a pint is bad, or is that your next book?
No. That is absolutely true. There are books available on final product quality. There are also, interestingly enough, programs for some of the people in the industry that are actually sending out, shall we say, non-technical people into the trade, are visiting pubs, are visiting outlets, liquor stores, whatever, supermarkets, are faced with questions. Look, I've stored this beer here, and now people are coming back and saying it's stale. What do I do? And often these people are not technically trained, because they are sales representatives, they are commercial kind of people. And we have drawn up programs exactly to fill that kind of gap. So there are books on the market. I can't think of anything that I would recommend at the moment, but do keep an eye open, and there are various organizations that would assist with getting those sort of books.
In your examples of beer, you've always used wheat as an example. Is that your favorite?
Funny enough, they used to be my favorites, and let's get back onto drinkability. I find them great, but I find them that, and I have to be careful what I say, but you can't have more than two. Mm-hmm. And I would always have a wheat beer because I like wheat beers, but if I'm sitting down with the intention of having a great evening with a couple of beers and perhaps a couple of friends, sometimes these two are interchangeable, I would opt for something which is a little bit lighter, a little bit more, a little bit less filling, shall we say. And at the moment, if you're asking me for some personal favorites, I'm very partial at the moment to these sort of Bavarian style lager beers, which are not quite as strongly hopped as their northern German and Belgian and British counterparts, but are a lot more Moorish because I find them well-rounded. But I know a lot of people would disagree, and they say their opinion would be these beers are a little bit too bland. And it's one of these transformation one goes through. You know, I used to always like very bitter beers, and now at the moment, you know, bitterness is not that important. But who knows what happens next? Maybe in 5 years' time, I would have changed my preferences again.
So if you're trapped on a desert island, we'll bring you a crate of Bavarian wheat beer. But if you're trapped in the icy tundra, is there anything else you prefer?
I would definitely go for a stout type, perhaps even a little bit stronger than the famous Irish stout. Perhaps something around 5 to 5.5% ABV. Also, if one looks at the different ranges of stout, and I think this is quite interesting, one of the products that I'm particularly partial to in terms of the black beers is something called an oatmeal stout, where part of the input into the brewing process in terms of the raw material is being taken up by oats. Now, oats are not particularly very fermentable, which means there will be always a higher level of what we call the residual extract. In other words, what I'm trying to say is that this beer tends to be quite creamy and filling, but, you know, as I said, there's a time and a place for everything, and you asked me if this was the right beer to be enjoyed around the Arctic Circle, and I'd say definitely this would be my first choice.
So that introduces other health benefits over the usual ones found in stouts and the extra iron in things like Guinness.
Yes, and also in terms of something that is up and coming in terms of looking at potentially gluten-free beers. Well, I know this is a totally different topic that'll take us another afternoon to discuss, but there's good indication that oats are actually gluten-free, so there could be an added health benefit there as well.
That's good news, especially for a friend of mine, as she's allergic to gluten.
Well, but don't forget that even those beers, like an oatmeal stout, is only made with an admixture, or what we call the adjunct. But the body of the beer is still being made with standard barley malt. So, and if she has a problem with that, you know, one still needs to be a little bit careful, I suppose.
That must be one of the few cases where a beer isn't good for you. Almost every beer I know is kosher, most are vegetarian or vegan. And with the use of the fish bladders in decline, the...
That's the isinglass, the fish protein that enhances the sedimentation rate of the yeast cells. Yes, but you're quite right. There's very little in beer that is actually not good for you. And certainly this is why a lot of the functional drinks that are coming on the market are now malt-based, because it's an easily digested type of carbohydrate. Beer also generally doesn't have as much alcohol as wine. So it's a fantastic all-rounder.
And on that note, we say, John Brower, thank you very much.
Thank you. Cheers.
Quick tastings. In this section, we give a brief yet discriminating summary of a number of different beers from around the world. All have been personally tasted and graded. Naturally, everyone has different tastes, and these are mine, so your mileage may vary. Grand Union Gold, from Grand Union. This is one of several traditional ales from this Middlesex brewery. This is a smoother and less bitter than the Union Bitter, and is supplemented with a decent aroma. It has a light, hollow aftertaste that sits well in the mouth, and despite winning a gold award in the Best Bitter category at 2005's Reading Beer Festival, it doesn't really excel for me, despite being a decent bitter. It's 4.2% and scores 6.5 out of 10. Tournament, from the Goth Brewery. At 4%, this is an amber brown beer with a thin head and an old-fashioned malt taste on the tongue. There's a slight but interesting biscuit taste here too, which follows up with a soft lingering aftertaste. The thin liquid texture is unexpected, but not surprising on reflection, as this is a local style beer. It has also won Gloucestershire's Champion Best Bitter title, and it's 7 out of 10 from me. Floris Passion. This is a 3% Belgian fruit beer with a grassy bouquet and a very Guise-like texture. It's nice, although there's not as much detectable passion fruit as you'd expect from a fruit beer from Floris. It's standard 3% alcohol, but an above average 6.5 out of 10. Fuller's 1845. This has won Camra's Champion Bottled Conditioned Beer of Britain at least 3 times, and at 6.3%, you can tell one way in which the judging can be swayed. This is a highly spiced rich ale, with copper and ruby colour, and available in bottles only. It has a good malt taste to it, with a slightly sour but pleasant taste as well. There's a fulsome mouthfeel, and like many ales of this type, score highly. In this case, 8.5 out of 10. Try Before You Die. In this section of the show, we will cast a discerning eye over the best beers that this world has to offer. We shall mention its history, the brewery behind the beer, and why we feel this is a superior brew worthy of your attention. This week, Rottenbach Grand Cru. This is a 6% hazy red-bodied beer with a small white head. It has a sweet, fruity aroma and a slightly tart flavour. There's also some fruit and hints of oak in here too, leading to a complex wash of tastes, which is augmented by its long fermentation process. The medium body is loaded with moderately high carbonation and a smooth but tart finish. The brewery itself began in 1821 by a blind middle-class man called Alexander Rottenbach, who was later involved in the revolution and declaration of Belgium as an independent state, which occurred in 1830. The business remained owned by the family until 1998, when it passed to Palm, although the family itself had relinquished direct control of the brewing aspects from as long ago as 1889. Despite this, they've maintained a consistent quality to the beer others would do well to study. There are two other Rottenbach beers of interest. The 5% original, which is made by combining old and new ale into the same beer, and the Redbach, which blends this original beer with cherry juice. This beer really lives up to the Grand Cru title and gets the deserved nickname of Happy Juice. It's also worthy of the title, Try Before You Die. Okay, that wraps it up for this week. To give us a tasting of your opinions, you can email us on thebeercrate@gmail.com. If you prefix the subject line with two colons, you can be sure to avoid the spam filters. Remember to enjoy everything from the Beer Crate safely and responsibly, so you can be back here with us next week. Until then, cheers. Has been released under the Creative Commons Attribution, No Commercial, No Derivatives version. See www.thebeercrate.com for details.